This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, and welcome to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. And I would have loved to introduce myself and the show in French, but I do not speak that beautiful and romantic language, but Lindsay Tremuda does. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And the reason you're here is because Paris is not new, but somehow you were able to write a book about its newity, about its rebirth, in this way that I feel like Brooklyn has had a very similar trajectory in the past 10 years, that we found ourselves in arts and crafts and DIYs and small business, and that small business has grown to the point where it has national, if not international, appeal. Not to say that Paris doesn't have that international appeal. It is the first modern city in Europe. It is the city of light, the place that everyone wants to go to and be taken away by. What do you consider Paris to you? Is it an old city? Is it a new city? Is it burgeoning on something else?
So that's a really good question. I think what really motivated any of the work that I've done on Paris is the blending of the two. So it's been at a crossroads, trying to reconcile its very, very heavy and sometimes burdensome past that has held them back from embracing all of the things that they could be. In recent years, they've really started to open up and see, you know, all the good things that can come from trying to look forward and create and innovate, but still respect the past. And so I think they've done a beautiful job, and they being food artisans or crafters or artists, people in tech, you know, all across the board, they've done a beautiful job of honoring what came before and then building for the future. And so I think it took a lot of things for it to get to that point. And now I don't see it stopping.
Yeah.
It's really on a road to huge things.
Do you see the parallels of your hometown, Philadelphia? I know you go and visit the Liberty Bell and it's like, that's still got a crack in it.
Yeah. Well, actually, when I go to the Liberty Bell, I'm like, oh yeah, this is, once you've been to Europe, this really isn't as quite as a thrilling of an experience. But, no, it's true. I sort of always felt like Philadelphia was phenomenal as a place, and especially as a food city, but always in the shadows of New York and other places. And so it's exciting to be in a city also that is very established, but has had to cross certain obstacles throughout its recent history in the role it maintains and its influence in a bigger food conversation globally. And certainly other global cities. I mean, I travel a lot. You travel a lot. A lot of people are traveling with greater ease. And so they end up in places where, you know, the food is either on the rise or super fundamental to a local culture and are, you know, having transformative food experiences. And Paris needed to sort of up the ante and certainly correct some of the ills that were plaguing it for quite a while, namely the fact that there were sort of poor ingredients being used in the things that you sort of expected by default were going to be good. You know, that was holding it back in a lot of ways, and then it was too hemmed in by its past. Again, that's something that you could say has been problematic for Paris for a long time. And so now I feel like it finally is like, this is who we are. We've got a lot of different cuisines now, and, you know, take us seriously. We're not just this like stuffy French cuisine focused dining scene. There's a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, but did you even approach Paris as a food city? Or I know your background is in French and literature. Did you just hope to go over there and smoke and write soliloquies?
So no to the smoking. I honestly wanted to become fluent. I wanted to master the language. And so my first opportunities of being there helped get me toward that, you know, further along on that path. And to be honest, I was actually quite a picky eater my whole life until I moved there. And it sort of forced me to confront some of my xenophobic eating habits, let's say. That's what my parents used to say, to call it. And that was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. So I developed an interest in food, despite having been someone who was like, yeah, I'm just gonna make some scrambled eggs and, you know, very, very minimalist in what I was eating and certainly not very adventurous. So, you know, to explore a renowned food city as someone who doesn't really love food to the degree that, you know, and this was before, obviously, we're talking 11 years ago. This is before everyone and their mother seemed to suddenly care about what they were eating, you know, but France is a place where people care by default of what they're eating. So I think that also influenced my turn toward, you know, being someone who's very interested in what's behind what I'm going to choose to eat and, you know, how it was prepared. I can't say I love cooking. That has not, I have not adopted that passion, but, you know, I'm amazed at what people can do with food, ingredients, their hands, you know, creatively speaking. So going back to your question, I didn't go for the food, but I actually found myself in some sort of a culinary awakening.
Yeah. Your blog, Lost in Cheeseland, was it named before or after that awakening?
That was named for, it was a place I knew was obsessed with cheese. I was starting to fall in love with cheese and I was quite lost in the beginning. So it was sort of, what kind of name can I come up with to stand out? This obviously at a time, we're going on 10 years ago, where 9 years ago, where there were numerous blogs. Blogs were the thing. And so what do you call something to maybe stand out? And I just wanted it to be kind of tongue in cheek and funny. And so I've stayed with it. But no, I mean, so it actually happened as I was on the road to finding myself into food. So simultaneous, I'd say.
Was that first food cheese that made you feel like you were eating French food?
And bread. Just copious amounts of bread. And fortunately, I've moved on to better bread. Far better bread. And I know, you know, what is and isn't good. I can't say I have baguette very often. That's sort of like the bottom of my, of the hierarchy of things I'm really interested in eating. That's like quite low. But those two things are so fundamental and also so comforting. And I was always into cheese, you know, like even on anything, you know, and that's the Italian side of me. I think, you know, if there's not, I can't have anything Italian without some Parmesan somewhere in there, which might be seen as a crime to some people. But, you know, that's just, so the cheese was easy for me to sort of latch onto as something comforting when I was there. And the sweets, that's pretty easy to get on board with.
Yeah, so I mean, there are all these entry points, and I'm almost thinking of Paris as a city, and how the roads, you know, circle around that city, and there are all these, what do they call them, ports?
Yep.
Yeah, and
that's where it becomes, once you pass the, let's say, Porte de la Chapelle or Porte de Clignancourt, you're beyond city limits then.
Yeah, so I've been to Paris and where I've been driving around those ports in a circle. And it kind of feels like you were in that same kind of orbit for a while, trying to figure out how to enter Paris.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think for many people, I mean, even for some French people who are from other places in the country, there is this, you know, there's a level of, so not status, but there's a standard and you don't know how you're going to be perceived, right? So the Parisians have a certain attitude and not necessarily a poor attitude. They just have a way about them. And so if you're from Marseille or you're from London, you know, it's navigating a whole new universe, just like people come to New York and they don't really know the proper codes right away. And so I felt that was what it was like for me in Paris. And then you quickly learn so you can sort of integrate yourself behaviorally into many, many different situations, but there's still something about you that will remain foreign. And that's something I've battled the 11 years I've been there. And now I feel probably more French than I feel American, but I'll still always be une Américaine.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the way.
What are the proper codes to order something like du café crème, s'il vous plaît?
I mean, you always say bonjour first. And that actually goes well beyond the food space. If you go into a shop and you want to ask someone a question, you do not go, yes, I'd like to know. No, it's bonjour. Oui, j'ai une question. And then you go on. And of course, we all learn the hard way, which is you go up to a salesperson or, you know, a butcher or whatever. And you just say, yes, I'd like. And then they go, uh-huh, bonjour. And so they tell you right away that you just committed a crime, you know, a social crime. So that's definitely something you would do in a cafe as well. You know, bonjour, oui, I would, you know, if you say it in French, oui, j'aimerais bien un café crème, s'il vous plaît.
I'm just going to take that audio clip and replay it while I'm in Paris.
So. I could also come with you. Yeah. I'll just be your personal orderer.
But I think that was always my fear about Paris. The first time I went, I knew there were these proper codes and there was this etiquette attached to it. And I was so fearful of doing that incorrectly or offending and Paris isn't like that anymore.
No.
It feels so accessible, and not just because I've been there numerous times, but it is a new Paris in that sense.
No, it's had to wake up to a lot of things. So it wasn't just cooking, it wasn't just the food itself, but it's also how you're treating customers. And I think certainly what's been beautiful to see is this whole sort of either these wine cellars, these wine bars, the neo bistros, you know, everything that's been made more informal. They all seem to be influenced by experiences they've had elsewhere. So that might mean, you know, the owner is foreign, or the owner has spent time in, you know, I don't know, San Francisco, Tokyo, wherever, where there is an emphasis on treating people properly. And there's this idea, I think, also of wanting to create regulars. If you look at a lot of these Septime La Cave, you look at Buvette, you look at some of those restaurants in that same genre, people go all the time, and there's a reason. It's because there's a sense of community, and you can't create that community without treating people well. And I also think with social media, people can't get away with it anymore. You start blasting on about how horrible your service was at X, Y, and Z, and that's actually going to have an effect. You know, Google reviews, all of those things are now super important, where they weren't or not even existent, you know, some time ago. And you'd have to rely on, you know, a journalist to be really completely honest about a service experience in a newspaper or a magazine. So now it's so instantaneous, as you know, that they can't really get away with, you know, horrid service. It still happens, but it's much less so.
You know, and with an influx of 29 million people per year as visitors to that city, you have to embrace that.
Yeah. And I mean, has that trickled down to the taxis? I mean, it's still a work in progress, but certainly there's, it feels to me like a far more global city, and not just, I mean, before, I mean, it's in population been very, very cosmopolitan, but not in attitude. And I think that's what's the biggest change, is seeing the way there's just greater acceptance for outside influence. And that doesn't mean that you're losing the Frenchness or a Parisianness. Because as I'm sure you know, Parisians were very, very, and not just Parisians, but the French in general, were very concerned that by accepting, I don't know, burgers and all of these other types of foreign concepts, that they were going to somehow lose their sense of self, and Paris was not going to look like Paris. And it always makes me laugh that people compare Paris to Brooklyn, which I think is just completely incomparable in terms of vibe. To say, you know, an area of Paris is like Brooklyn, especially when people haven't really spent, you know, enough time in both, seems like an easy thing. Just like, you know, let's just fill a box. What is Paris like? But I think Paris operates on an entirely different wavelength. It's not better, it's not worse, but you know, there are things that are just universally now interesting for diners, if we're talking about food. And so it's not that surprising that it would eventually make its way into Paris. And that doesn't mean it's copying Brooklyn or it's, you know, trying to be more like London. Its population wants those things.
I will say both cities share a penchant for dogs pooping between parked cars.
I mean, that's just, I don't know that that's going to ever change, much to my grave disappointment, but
as much as things change, they still say the same.
Well, exactly. That's exactly right.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Lindsay Tremuda in the new Paris.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
Hey, and welcome back to the Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, here today with Lindsay Tremuda of The New Paris. First of all, just flip to the back of the book, because the guide alone, you know, that index of places to go, to eat, to drink, to shop and see is a book in and of itself. And I feel like that should be a guide that most Americans, if not all, receive as they deboard in Charles de Gaulle, because it's really outstanding.
It was the hardest part to put together, because I had to, you know, you only have so many pages, as you know, and it really needed to be a tight list. So that was probably the most painful part of the whole book.
Yeah, but then you must hate this next question.
Oh,
I'm going to Paris. Where should I eat?
Well, I would follow up with another annoying question, which is, well, what's your budget? Where are you staying? How far do you want to go? What are you allergic to? Because that's another question you really need to ask.
But what is the path through Paris that really kind of shows where it's been in the past decade or two? Who starts that movement of bistronomy, neo-bistros, the places you eat today?
Well, most people, and most of the people writing about food in the last decade, will point to Yves Comdebald with his work. And today you will find him at L'Avant Comptoir. He has a few other locations, and he's doing other things right in that immediate area in Saint-Germain. So he's very much a fixture of the left bank. You've got Stéphane Jégot of La Mijan in the 7th arrondissement. Again, not in the east side of the city, where much of the bigger change happened later. People like them were super important in taking the white tablecloth off the table and saying, like, let's stop being stuffy about this. And so then you had, obviously, people like Bertrand Gribault of Septime, who was really the first person to elevate the level of cooking. So sort of Michelin standard, more gentle prices, and, you know, bare wood tables, very almost rustic feeling, open kitchen plan. And so it felt very accessible. And he was one of the first people really to show diners that you could still be creative and not have this beautiful plating and this beautiful produce, and how he could sort of create within a certain season or with whatever he could get at the market. And it still be beautiful without costing a fortune. So he was another one more recently who is extremely instrumental in the way neo-bistro cooking has played out.
Yeah, I mean, it blows my mind that these tenets of natural, seasonal, creative didn't really apply to a lot of Parisian cooking before. I've also been to Rungis, which is what Leal was, the marketplace in the city, then moved outside near Orly Airport. And to see food removed so far from the city center, it's kind of allegory to what happened in Paris and why there is this new renaissance.
For sure. And I think as people being consumers and diners are more and more concerned with what they're eating, they want to make sure that if they're going to spend, even if it's 20 euros, 25 euros on something, they're going to want to know that it's not coming from, you know, it's not just been pulled from the microwave. And that, unfortunately, was the case for a lot of places. And it's still probably true today in some, you know, in some spots of the city. But there's been a real push to transparency. And so that's now sort of standard. You come in and you know, it's found out that you've, you know, fooled people in some way. Parisians do not take kindly to that. And so what's nice about it is that you can have an experience at some of these restaurants that's ever changing. Daniel Rose, obviously, who's been in the news a lot for the Le Coucou in New York, he's got Chez La Vieille and La Bourse et la Vie, which are very classic bistros in Paris, and the menu tends toward classic recipes that you might find in a cookbook. So there's maybe less in the way of hyper seasonality. The menu doesn't necessarily change every single day, but you can have both the classic and something that's completely dependent on, you know, what they were able to get in from the local producer. And Terroir d'Avenir, which is a purveyor, a local food purveyor, you know, they supply vegetables and meat to a lot of the big restaurants like Frenchie, like, you know, name a neo bistro and they're probably working with them at least for some of their products. And I know long ago, and it may even have been Gregory Marchand at Frenchie who said to me once that, you know, all the chefs would get a text message the night before the new delivery of, okay, I've got three rabbits, we've got X number of, you know, whatever. And it's up to the chefs to respond quickly and claim it. So that's why sometimes you were seeing some of these unusual pairings on menus as well, is because, okay, the chefs were going to cook whatever they could get their hands on. And so there's a lot of spontaneity and creativity that comes out of that kind of restraint or limitation.
I think it's interesting you mention Daniel Rose and, you know, Frenchie, Gregory, in the same vein, because they one had a stint in New York. Gregory worked at Gramercy Tavern before going back to his native France. And Daniel, you know, is a Chicagoan, cooked in Belgium, France, etc. But he may be one of those un American
right.
that you speak of. But then there's Charles Compagnon. Yeah, who has Le Richer. And he spent time in New York kind of formalizing the ideas that he wanted to take back to Paris.
And he spent time at the James Beard Foundation for just under a year or so. And he comes from a long line of Auvergnat. So people from Auvergne are in the food business. And he essentially upped the ante as well with, you know, all-day service and... you know, at least at the 52 Faubourg Saint-Denis, which is my favorite, and I'm sorry, that's like really long-winded, but we call it the 52 otherwise. You know, you can go in at any time of day and have something, and it's all going to be delicious, and wines are really affordable, and it's so accessible, and they're so accommodating even, which is not something you would normally expect from a brasserie that's open all day. So I would call his 52 a neo-brasserie, and then he's got Le Richer, which is a couple blocks over, and that's more of a neo-bistro, and then he has a more formal restaurant called L'Office, so that one you can actually make reservations at. But again, it's like, I don't ever worry when I go in there that I won't find something I'm in the mood to eat. I know it'll be different, and it's always delicious. And actually, I took my sister who came to Paris for the first time last year, and she had some temporary allergies, and I was like, okay, how am I going to do this? And they were sort of like strange / fundamental ingredient type of allergies, right? Like onions and garlic. And those are in a lot of French dishes. And I asked Charles actually if his team would be able to accommodate within those restrictions. And he's like, absolutely, just tell them. And they totally worked around it for her and gave her one of the best experiences she had in Paris that whole trip. And you wouldn't necessarily think that a neo bistro like that, where with such a menu that's, you know, created clearly from whatever was picked up at the market, that they would necessarily be willing to make amendments in that way. And I think ultimately there are more and more intolerances, and they've had to get used to accommodating in that way.
Well, I mean, comfort equals accommodating more so than anything else these days. And, you know, for an American going to Paris, luckily there are things like Chinese food and Texas barbecue there now too.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I didn't even grow up with Texas barbecue and I realized what I was missing in my life before. Thomas Abramovich lived in New York for several years while he was working for LVMH, the conglomerate, and was living with a Texan. And so he sort of brought him into the tradition of Texas barbecue. He spent Thanksgiving in Texas, and you know, he sort of like found his calling, so to speak, and has opened a place called The Beast, and now he's got The Beast 2, which it's in Belleville. And actually, what's super cool, because you mentioned Chinese food just before, there's a second restaurant within the second Beast location called Son of a Beast, and he is doing Chinese smoked tasting menu not smoked for the sake of smoking something, but finding at least in one dish, so let's say it's some sort of dumpling, that some element will be smoked and not overpowering, but it's testing how he can incorporate and use the smoker to sort of shake up different types of cuisine. And it's phenomenal. So, you know, it's super original. He has shown us that a Frenchman can absolutely bring something foreign to the table and do it kind of masterfully.
Can a Frenchman bring something American like a burger to a truck and make it masterful?
They've done that, although it did start with an American woman. So Kristen Frederick really brought that trend to Paris. And now we don't even talk about food trucks, really. They're still there. But most of them have actually used that as a stepping stone to get into a real brick and mortar space. So, you know, I don't have to go searching for burgers. That's part of the landscape. And no one sees that as like an offense to French culture. You know, yeah. It's on even your worst brasserie or corner cafe menus. You'll have a crappy burger on there, but you know, it just goes to show you how it's something that the Parisians actually really were ordering, you know, even at its early stages, it was something they were hungry for, and now it's everywhere. And, but not in your face way. It's just, it's there and you know where to get it when you want it.
The only thing I liked about burgers pre-burger truck day in Paris was that I got to call it McDo.
Oh, yeah. Well,
but not that I ever went to McDonald's, but I thought it was a cute little euphemism.
Well, and that's not slowed in its client base, honestly. I mean, Parisians, sadly, will go there. So I know how people often think that Parisians just somehow have far better taste than everyone else, and I tend to disagree.
Yeah, I mean, well, let's go back to bread, which we initially talked about, and you said, you know, baguettes are kind of at the lower end. Mm-hmm. And what I often hear is you have to go to Dupin
des Idées.
And but why? What is so good about this new era of bread in Paris? What is so inventive?
Well, first of all, if you have to look at the way bread was treated before. You go into a cafe, a brasserie, wherever, a restaurant, not a fine dining restaurant, but just, you know, another restaurant. And bread is served to you free of charge. It's not like Italy where, you know, you touch those breadsticks, you're going to pay for them. And so there was this thinking that it's like, well, we're giving this to you for free, so you'll take what we give you, basically. And unfortunately, that did not go with a lot of type of cooking. And bread didn't need to be this afterthought. It really could be flavorful. And also, there was a lot of bread being done poorly. Baguettes, you know, they do have to respect certain steps. Just like the baguette tradition, which is the crunchier one, the one I would eat. And same thing with sourdough. Like, it wasn't being done the way it should have been. And I think you had some of these bakers who wanted to change that and saw an opportunity. Christophe Vasseur at Dupin et des Idées, he has a line around the block every single day of the week, and not the weekend because he's closed. and that does not, you know, ruin his business in any way, but he's got something called the Pain des Amis, which is very rustic. It's crunchy, it's flavorful, it's hearty, and a lot of cafes are sourcing the bread from him. You also now have 10 Bells Bread. So 10 Bells is a coffee shop, and the owners opened another location. So it's both coffee shop, and they're making all of their breads, all of their sandwiches, all of their baked goods. And so you have people who are really putting a lot of focus on bread because it should not be an afterthought.
You know, there are all these very singular things, and I never know how to say this word, but they're those little cream puffs.
Ah, merveilleux.
Someone can be so focused on these singular things now and kind of be lauded for that. Like, I go to Jacques Chenin for those mango caramels.
Oh, yeah.
And I take as many pâté de fruit as possible. But what are the singular food items that people are craving right now and the craftspeople are just hitting on all cylinders?
Well, you had for a while, you know, the eclair shops. L'Eclair de Génie was, one of them that has actually expanded very, very quickly, even since the book came out. And he's opened sort of everywhere, it seems, and focusing on the eclair. You had, obviously, at one point, shops that really specialized in macaron, did some other things, but, you know, really their signature was the macaron. And Au Merveilleux de Fred, which is also in New York City, they have one location. that's the focus. And actually, it started in Lille, so in the northern part of France, and that is still their best city. So Paris, although he has the pastry chef has a couple of locations, Lille is still the best performing city. But you know, in Paris, that's all they have, basically. And like you described, they're meringue mounds that are filled with some sort of a cream and coated with, let's say, chocolate or coffee crunchy things. And it's actually quite light and airy and delicious. And I think the idea for many chefs is it is really hard economically to have a viable pastry shop when you're producing, I don't know, sometimes 20 something pastries, and you know, and then you're doing sablé cookies and you're doing marshmallows and you're doing chocolates and all of these things. I mean, to break even, that's certainly kind of difficult. So if you can master how to scale one thing and do it perfectly, well, you have yourself a model that was certainly very attractive to some of these people following the economic crisis. And certainly, you know, it appeals because it's just that one thing. And if you go to a normal pastry shop with different types of desserts, you're not going to get the variety in eclairs, for example, that you would get at just going to that one store. So certainly and I think people have too much choice. I mean, I come to New York City and I'm like, I don't know what to eat. I don't know where to go. There's way too much here. The bagel alone is like, you know, a 15-minute decision. And I think that's what a lot of people feel also when they go to Paris and they see these beautiful bakeries and they don't know how to choose. And so I think it adds something nice to the offering. It takes a little bit of indecision out of choosing what you're going to nosh on.
Or if you need all those options played out in front of you, there's Maison Plisson.
Right, there's Maison Plisson, but actually my favorite is Food de Pâtisserie, which is a concept pastry shop. I mean, maybe you'd call it like the Colette of pastry. And they actually, what's interesting is that's run by the editors of a magazine of the same name, a food magazine. And so they've developed over the years a relationship with Pierre Hermé, with Cyril Lignac, with, you know, plenty of other pastry chefs who were willing to give up sort of control over how their products are sold and talked about and gave a couple of different of recipes, a couple different pastries to this store every single day. And so it's, you have a little bit of Pierre Hermé, you have a little bit of Jacques Genin, you have a little bit of Carl Marletti, who's another chef I really like. And so you can go to the second arrondissement and pick up something so you don't have to race around town. You're like, oh, I want to go to, you know, Pierre Marcolini, but he's across town. But up right here, you can get a bunch of them in one spot. So
and you are that source too. I mean, and the New Paris, you have this curatorial ability to kind of guide someone along their best Parisian path. And, you know, with that, I usually go to a city and the first thing I really want to know is where to get a good drink. Mm. And craft cocktails are certainly on the rise in Paris. They're very well established there now. And I feel like you get some of your best information over a couple libations at night. So where would you go to drink and what are those bartenders that would tell you the right places to go to in the morning?
Well, it depends how many of them are actually awake in the morning, I guess. Some of them have really late nights. They all seem to, you know, frequent the guys in the food business as well. So, you know, when you're hanging out in that kind of environment, you can at least be sure they know a few places for where to eat. So I really like the team at Le Marie Celeste. It's the Quixotic Projects, who's behind the Marie Celeste, behind Candelaria, which Candelaria is always ranked in the top, I want to say 30. I think the top 30 of the world's best bars in the world. That's redundant, world's best bars. And they also have Glass Hero, and they just opened Les Grands Verts at the Palais de Tokyo, which is their biggest venture to date. And Le Marie Celeste is a good vibe. People there, I know they like good food because the food actually at the bar is very good. And then I really like Sullivan Doe and what he does at Le Syndicat and more recently at La Commune. So he's got two bars. He's now more at La Commune, which is in Belleville. And he's the one who completely brought French spirits back into the to the forefront. Parisians and I would say overall French drinkers don't really know, you know, much about cognac or Armagnac and certainly not how it can blend into cocktails. So he's been a proponent of classic French spirits and preserving that. And he again knows where to go for coffee. We'll know where to, you know, go get a light bite to eat. So, and those are only two. So I think that's a good start at least.
Yeah. Yeah. And there is so many great places to start in Paris. It's almost unfair for me to ask you that question again. Where would you go to eat? Where would you go to drink? Once again, it's all in your book, so people can read the new Paris for that information. But where do you hope Paris goes? What direction do you hope food and drink takes? And can Paris change any more than already has?
I think there's still room for growth, for sure. I mean, I think there's a lot that needs to be done in the area of sustainability, and there are a couple of places that are trying to get behind that. Namely, again, Les Grands Verts, so quixotic projects with the Palais de Tokyo restaurant. They've made low waste a priority in what they're doing. You can see that even from the lack of bottles behind the bar. You know, they get all of their liquor and their spirits delivered, and they, or, you know, it's been delivered in some sort of large jug, and then they transfer it to glass bottles that they have, but they're not, you know, they're trying to do reuse and limited packaging and low waste as much as possible. And I think, you know, for a long time, you have chefs that will do whole beast cooking. So you're not going to waste any element of an animal. And that is super noble, you know, something to uphold. However, does that extend to vegetables? And are you composting? And are you doing all these things? And I think that, you know, Paris already is a very polluted city, unfortunately. And, you know, if restaurants can make an effort in their own way to kind of reduce the carbon footprint and, you know, help where they can, I think that can actually do a lot of good in educating the dining population. So I think there's room there. I think in terms of Mexican food, we're still hovering around tacos and burritos and that kind of thing, where I just ate at Cosme, is that how you pronounce it, last night? And that blew me away. And it was super flavorful, super creative, and, you know, it has obviously Mexican elements to it, but is just beautiful food. And I think we need to get away from those sort of, not stereotypical, but certainly those signature cuisines in any type of cooking, and see how we can push that further.
I really feel like Paris is now a city of multiculturalism. Mm-hmm. If it wants it or not, you know, it really has kind of embraced that 29 million people come in and out of that city a year. And some people, like Lindsay Trumuda, stay and thankfully become guides for us by writing The New Paris. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you for having me. This was a treat.
And if we haven't told you enough great things about that great city, she too has her own podcast called The New Paris Podcast. And where can we find that?
On iTunes, SoundCloud, wherever you download and stream apps.
Excellent. Well, I'll see you soon in Paris for Café Crème.
Can't wait. Yeah.
Excellent. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Big thank you to Castor and Pollux for sponsoring, music by Cookies, and David Tadashore Engineering. Hope to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.